Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the Islamic Republic would return to its nuclear commitments only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions first. Iran holds a ceremony to launch the clinical trial of its second domestically made coronavirus vaccine. Palestinian rights groups say Israeli forces arrested more than 450 people across the occupied West Bank in January. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, beginning with comments of leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, saying that if the United States lifts all the sanctions, Tehran will live up to its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The leader said that Iran won't listen to those, be it in Europe or the U.S., talking nonsense with regards to the sanctions. The leader added that Washington and the three European countries, which have violated all their commitments under the nuclear agreement, are not entitled to set conditions. He stressed that it's Iran which has the right to set conditions, as it has delivered on all its obligations. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iran, after verifying that sanctions have been lifted in practice, will return to its commitments. He said that this is Iran's definitive policy, and the country won't drop that policy. From Tehran, I'm joined by Mustafa Khoshchesh, journalist and commentator. Welcome to the show, Mr. Khoshchesh. You heard Iran's leader comments. Also, we had the Iran top diplomat yesterday also warning the U.S. that the clock is ticking and they don't have time, you know, to think about this, and that time is running out and they're going to need to actually do something about this. So let's have your evaluation.
Hello and thanks for having me. Well, you know, this shows more than anything else that Iran has no trust in the U.S. All throughout the last two decades, there have been deals between Iran and the United States or the Europeans based on what the European diplomats as well as American diplomats, senior and top American officials, have always stressed that Iran has been in compliance with the terms of the agreements that it had signed with the U.S. or with the Europeans. And the party that has never been loyal to the deals has been the United States and the Europeans. So this is nothing new. But the difference is that they've been working on Tehran for quite a long time, for two decades, to make Tehran believe that the U.S. is looking for a conflict resolution, while this has never been the case. They've never been after resolving the conflict with Tehran. They've just been trying to harness Iran's power within the containment strategy through sanctions as well as posing credible military threat. Well, now Tehran is sending the signal that it has no trust in the U.S., that it would not believe the U.S. president's signature, that they have to remove the sanctions. Tehran would wait until it sees the impact and the effect of the decision by the U.S. in practice, in action, and then it would embark on complying with the nuclear deal. This is a major difference. I mean, this is a small point that Tehran would wait until the U.S., if it comes back to the nuclear deal and signs, and President Biden signs the agreement, joining the agreement and removal of the sanctions, then Tehran would wait until it sees the impact in action. This is the first very important point. A second point is that apparently the United States wants to get back to the JCPOA, but without lifting the sanctions. Probably President Biden is preparing to issue an executive order to say that they've reversed the decision about the nuclear deal, but they would not remove the sanctions. This is not rejoining the nuclear deal. Being in the, under the nuclear deal has its own terms and meanings. They should remove the sanctions first. And it's Iran that's still in compliance with one-third of its commitments. So Tehran should say what the U.S. needs to do. More importantly, Biden is looking for the same containment strategy that started under Obama and was continued under President Trump. And this containment strategy, as I said before, they rely very much on efficiency of sanctions and the threats and for changing the calculations of Iranian decision makers. That's what they do. And Tehran now knows how to play this game. Last year, after triple incidents in the Persian Gulf, including Iranian barrage of missile attacks on Ain al-Assad, the U.S. threats were discredited and they are no more credible. Now, after the two-year-long efficiency period, maximum efficiency period of the sanctions is gone last May, the efficiency of the sanctions is decreasing. And now it's Tehran that has the power to gather more leverage against the United States. Tehran has just resumed its 20% uranium enrichment. Tehran is going to end the voluntary implementation of the nuclear of the additional protocol to the NPT. And also, Iran has a wide variety of options to lay more and more leverage on the United States. Okay. Biden should decide if he wants to continue the same containment strategy, he would not receive a pulse from Tehran, definitely. He should opt for a conflict resolution and give up the weapon of the sanctions first.
Okay. I appreciate your comments and contribution, Mustafa Khoshesh, journalist and commentator in Tehran. Iranian medical experts have begun the clinical trial of another indigenously-developed coronavirus vaccine. Covapars is an inhalable vaccine developed using biotechnology. Relevant tests have already been conducted successfully on animals, including guinea pigs, hamsters, and monkeys. The Covapars vaccine has been developed by the Razi Institute, one of the most important medical research centers in West Asia. The launch of its human trial was announced in a ceremony in Tehran, attended by experts and officials. Addressing the gathering, Health Minister Saeed Namaki said that achievement is a source of national pride.
One of the major jobs done over the past few months was to rely on domestically developed technology to produce a vaccine. The COVID-19 vaccine is not a simple one to develop. As the virus, as the COVID-19 virus is a complex one, producing a vaccine for it is a very complex process.
The minister says it's not clear how effective the coronavirus vaccines developed by different countries are, but they are the only way available to help contain the disease. Iran has developed another COVID-19 vaccine called Coviran, which is under the first human trial phase. Volunteers who've received the shots have had no symptoms such as shock or fever after the injection. Now, Masoud Soleimani, a vaccine trials expert at the Iran University of Medical Sciences, has provided us with some details regarding the development process of the new Iranian coronavirus vaccine.
So they created the vaccine about in March last year, end of February, March last year. And then from March, they started the animal testing first on mouse and hamster and rabbit, and then by almost end of May, June, they started testing it on monkeys, the green African monkey, which is very close to human race. They started testing on that monkey, and since then until now, we have about 10 months of data. Which shows that this vaccine is safe, created no harm on these 23 monkeys that right now they are alive and well. And also they created a long-standing immune response, which what we need in an effective vaccine. Today, we had basically announcement of the start of the human phase of this vaccine. One of the innovations in this vaccine is that it consists of another third dose. The first dose is when you is in the form of inoculation. So the second, it comes about 3 weeks after the first dose. Again, it's an injection. And then it comes a month later comes the nasal spray, which is an innovation, as I said, in this vaccine, because we have studies that shows that if the nasal IgA immune response becomes activated, then the person will not be spread the virus. Because one of the problems is that when you are immune against the virus, you don't get the virus, you are immune, you are healthy, but you may still spread the virus from nasal secretion.
COVID-19 clusters on U.S. military bases in South Korea are raising the alarm with the country's public and activists. Many worry that the virus is being spread from U.S. service members to the general South Korean population. Frank Smith has a report from South Korea.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
The COVID-19 crisis deepening in America is despite efforts to contain it and its variants through vaccination and restrictive measures. Some 462,000 Americans have died since the first fatality was reported nearly a year ago. On Friday, the U.S. set a new record in daily fatalities with more than 5,000 deaths. The confirmed cases also approaching 27 million. Despite attempts to curb the surge in COVID figures, the U.S. remains the world's worst hit country by the pandemic in terms of both cases and deaths. Now, in Brazil, the deaths have surpassed 231,000. That's the second highest death toll worldwide. Officials registered 1,000 new fatalities on Saturday. They also recorded 50,000 cases, raising the total to nearly 9.5 million. In other news, the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations has warned that Iran will give a firm response to any Israeli military adventurism. Ajit Afghan issued the warning in a letter to UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council. Afghan said that Israel has recently intensified its provocative and hawkish remarks against Iran. It's planning to carry out the hostile threats. He described such threats as a blatant violation of the UN Charter. The Iranian envoy demanded an international response to, quote, Israel's destabilizing policies in the region. In January, Israel's Army Chief of Staff warned the U.S. against rejoining the Iran nuclear deal. Aviv Kochavi said that he had ordered his forces to gear up for a possible offensive against Iran. Several Palestinian rights organizations have reported the arrest of more than 450 people during different Israeli raids across the occupied West Bank in January. In a joint report, two organizations, including the Prisoners Affairs Commission and the Palestinian Prison Society, said that 93 minors and 8 women were among those detained last month. While that reportedly brings the number of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails to some 4,500. Some of them are put under the regime's so-called administrative detention for up to 6 months without trial, which is extended to unlimited periods. Palestinian rights groups have decried new Israeli detentions amid the coronavirus crisis. The report estimates over 350 Palestinian inmates have tested positive with COVID-19 in Israeli jails due to the regime's deliberate medical negligence. From Ramallah, let's bring in our correspondent, Mona Kandil. Mona, tell us more about the situation of the Palestinians in Israeli jails. We also hear there are also women and minors among them.
Well, Israel continues to arrest Palestinians under different excuses and justifications. People here in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem Al-Quds are being detained by the Israeli soldiers, mainly on a daily basis. Israeli forces raid cities, villages, and refugee camps and arrest people. The excuse would be that those people are wanted for security reasons, sometimes for taking part in anti-Israel demonstrations and protests, demonstrations against the wall and the Israeli military. People are also being detained by the Israeli soldiers for the reports on social media that are seen by the Israelis against the Israeli occupation regime. As you said, exactly 456 Palestinians were detained in January alone, including women and children. They are being held in a very difficult situation in Israeli jails and military centers. This is, of course, is illegal according to the international laws, especially now with the spread of the coronavirus, this pandemic. The prisoners, many of them were infected by COVID-19. Over 360 Palestinians were captured this pandemic from the Israeli jailers and from the Israeli guards. And they are not isolated. They don't receive medical care. They continue to face medical negligence by the Israeli military. Palestinians also are being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. In January alone, over 100 people, their trial were extended without knowing what the charges against them. Dozens of new orders were also imposed on Palestinians, and the Israeli regime continues to ignore the calls from the international community and the human rights organizations that they are demanded to either prosecute those Palestinians that are called administrative detainees or to release them. However, Israel insists to keep people behind Israeli bars in order to tell the Palestinians that they are living under Israeli occupation and that the Israeli regime is the one only controlling the occupied territories, whether the West Bank or Jerusalem Al-Quds.
Thanks for that, Mona Kandil, correspondent in Ramallah. Several Palestinian rights groups have praised the International Criminal Court for its decision to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the occupied territories. In a joint statement, the groups, including Al-Haq Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights and the Palestine Center for Human Rights, called the ICC ruling a landmark decision. They stressed that immediate action must be taken by the court to ensure justice and accountability for Palestinian victims. The ICC ruling says it has jurisdiction to investigate the situation in the Palestinian territories occupied by Tel Aviv in 1967. That includes the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Israeli Prime Minister has rejected the ruling as pure anti-Semitism. The first mass trial burial of Izzedi Kurds, killed by Daesh terrorists in northern Iraqi town of Sinjar 7 years ago, has been held in a local village. Amid tight security, relatives of the victims carried more than 100 coffins during the ceremony attended by official delegations and civil society organizations. In 2014, more than 3,000 Yazidis were killed and some 7,000 women and girls were abducted and sexually abused by Daesh in Iraq. The UN denounced the onslaught as genocide. The first exhumations of mass graves began in March 2019, led by a UN investigative team in collaboration with the Iraqi government. More than 80 mass graves have been discovered in the area. 19 of them have been dug up. And that's the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. And the first part saw how Lorna Taçasup made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we
said,
were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the sexy story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had my interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this SWAT camp. And all these women were all dolled up in this back room, and they put the Arabic music on, and they have the kerchiefs, and we're doing the dance, and we're just having like this blast. The Iraqi people are good-looking people. They love to look good. They're very fashionable. This is in a SWAT camp. These people are obviously very poor, but they're still, if they have only one set of clothes, they wash it every night. They go out, and they love to look good. Happiest when I'm there, you know, really, because, you know, you're doing your work. I feel like you're making some progress. You're helping the world a little bit.
Don't you think this building needs some work?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. He's 90 years old. He's still working.
I think of those young and old people who we've impacted each other. They've taught me so much about their culture, about life in Iraq. They've allowed me an insider's glimpse.
I really had a great day. You will never believe the miracle that happened. We were waiting for a taxi across the street from the hotel. Suddenly, this taxi rolled slowly over to us, as if by magic. And the guy driving was the man in the photo walking with crutches with one leg. And he remembered me taking his photo, so we made arrangements for him to come to the hotel and see his picture. Did you know that at the last minute, I grabbed my box of huge 20 by 24 photos? Yes, and I did have them here with me, and I can show people the photos. I gotta go now. My battery got fried yesterday when the electricity came on. I had no surge protector hooked to it. Much love to you, my sweetie. I'm missing you all the day long and talking to you in my heart. I miss you and love you very much. Love, Muma.
I have Commando Mommy photos, Liz. Where? I'm looking for them right now.
Commando.
We went over to Olive's house, and they wrapped me in a...
I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our future brighter and better for every one of our citizens. I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our country safe.
The Republican message is going to be, these are dangerous times, and President Bush will protect you.
And, you know, this is what we should be doing, and taking it to whatever degree we have to take it to. Getting arrested is not such a big thing when people are dying.
If we are a representative democracy and we supposedly have control over our government, what are we going to do about it?
Attendance is estimated between 100,000 and 300,000 people, though no official figures have been released. Overall, the march, peaceful, except for some altercations. So far, police report 134 arrests.
2005, I went back for the first election, and I almost got killed a couple of times. I was only actually in the country for 10 days, and I didn't go back for a couple of years because I was terrified. I was caught in a crossfire shootout, and, you know, here I am, an unarmed American woman traveling, you know, with cameras. And I would think, I must have been crazy coming here and walking on these streets.
Every night at the hotel, darkness would come and you'd hear, like, the machine gun fire out in the street or handgun fire out in the street, or sometimes they were, like, fighting each other. I don't know what was going on. Everywhere we went, there were guns. You can hear, like, them clicking the guns in the background. They're loading them, checking their clips. There's nothing like the sound of a Kalashnikov being loaded.
It was kind of like, oh, f-
attitude. You're not killing us today. And if you want to kill us, go ahead. Try. It was like, it was so intense. Like, gunfire broke out at one point, and no one left. Like, people refused to move, even though there was someone was shooting a gun at them. They told us, like, we went to the first polling place. They said, no, you cannot take any pictures of the National Guard or the police. So, yeah, I'm not going to break the rules. Soon, everybody wants me to take their picture. The policeman in charge, he said, here, take my picture. He took someone's kid. He was kissing the kid. He said, I want you to take my picture.
Now, remember, this last trip was very dangerous for me. I had to wear hijab the entire time and my abaya. My camera bag was a hidden woman's bag where I had, you know, and I had a press pass. I was even afraid to show that at times that someone would take me out. There were over 250 political parties. Here's the election ballot boxes. People came in, they voted. And that's the other thing, a lot of political parties suddenly come popping out of the woodwork, you know, because, oh, now we have democracy. Do we know what that means? Now we have freedom. Do we know what that means? I mean, it was a very beautiful, exciting time to see these people emerge from this snuffed-out dictatorship state to be just thinking about, now we're free. The first 3 weeks there, I didn't talk. I didn't write a word. I was too afraid to, because I had to get my mind on it. I had to wrap my mind around it, and I had to open to what they were saying and not what I was feeling, or not what I went there thinking.
No one is interested in the truth. So did I want to hear that half the people in Iraq were, you know, certainly large numbers of people love Bush? No, I don't want to hear that.
We are no killers. We are no terrorists. We are just looking for peace and beautiful life.
So what do you think should happen now?
Point, I had two choices. I could have submerged myself and refused to hear them and to seek out people who supported my belief system, or I could listen to what they were saying and try to understand why they were saying it. And that's what I decided to do. And it was painful, and it was hard, and it was shocking to me. But the bottom line is, it's very complex. In fact, the first article I wrote was called Making Peace with All the Truths. It's not one truth. It's a multifaceted truth. And it may not make sense, and it's not black and white, and it's not right or wrong. It is complicated. But, you know, it doesn't fit into a soundbite, so we can't use it. And that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm going to do. All I kept thinking the last 3 weeks I was there is I want to come home and plant my garden. Politics, the world, war.
Knowing what you know today, would you do the same thing all over again?
I think it is doubtful that without the weapons of mass destruction case, the President, the Congress, the United Nations, and those who joined us in the conflict, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Australians, would have found a persuasive enough case to support a decision to go to war.
I want our troops home. I want all this. I want all the children of the world home, and not in a war situation. Okay, but we can't get the troops home now because we've opened up Pandora's box, and people's lives are at risk. And it's about time. I mean, the left doesn't want to take responsibility for anything. The right doesn't want to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility. As an American, I have to take responsibility in my country. And I'm not going to abandon these people who I have gotten to know and who are telling me we're afraid that if you guys leave, the shit's going to hit the fan.
Would you classify your work, journalism, as anti-mainstream or alternative?
I don't think they have a category for me. And I went to Iraq to bring home the face of the Iraqi people so that the people in my country could see who they were killing and maybe think, these are beautiful people, why would we want to kill them? Infantile idealism.
As a journalist, what are you going to do? Are you prepared for dying?
You can't go there unless you accept that you may not.
My name is Lorna Tychostop. I'm an editor, writer, and photojournalist. I've been working in and out of Iraq now since February 2003. I'm going to continue to name the names of the fallen from the state of New Mexico. Specialist Christopher A. Merville. Age 26. Sergeant Moses Daniel Rocca, age 19.
The first time I read the first 19-year-old, I had to like wait a whole minute because I didn't want to
you know, had a Sergeant Tommy L. Gray, age 34. Jaffer Hashim Majid, age 13. Wissam Hadi Duari, age 11. Daud Kiss, age 55. Muhammad Agar, no age given. This is exactly where my photos belong, because people will see them. Ahmed Al-Rifai, age 13. The face of the Iraqi people has found a home.
At some point, I realized I didn't know enough to truly report in depth on the issues that I was learning about. So I went back to school. I found a master's program at NYU in global affairs. And by that time, I had begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Iraq. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter, scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them. And I was like, get who? As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, we're going to get them, the people who did this. And I said, well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them? Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy, family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark. And I think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Thank you.
Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only the warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. Today, I will be speaking about the cause of psychic afflictions. We have psychological diseases in our society today. In a social environment where people's thoughts revolve around the axis of materialism, especially in our modern society with the ideology of modernism and postmodernism, where materialism is in the center of our society, where wealth and passing material comforts are considered the criteria of prosperity and misfortune, and where everyone is constantly after the satisfaction of this inner urge, life is undoubtedly full of stress and anxiety. That is because no matter however and how much one's efforts may be, he or she cannot satisfy his endless greed, which is filled with mental vacuum, and realize all his desires and wishes, because there would always be someone else who has more than you and me. Thus, this carnal soul of ours will always want more and more and would never be satisfied with those desires and wishes and goals that we have in life. We will always want more. Often, there arise obstacles in the way of these desires and goals, which lead man into various kinds of misgivings and torments. His mind and nerves are greatly disturbed as a result of this mental vexation. Moreover, since his attachment is to unenduring things, which are prone every moment to destruction and extinction, their transitory charm cannot give tranquility or serenity to his tormented life. Such a person, dear brothers and sisters, no doubt will not feel happy within himself. The pursuit of happiness, which many people today talk about and try to pursue, is nothing to be pursued about. You do not pursue happiness. Happiness should be right now. You should feel serenity right now. And everything you do, there should be happiness. You have to elevate your soul to that level of happiness. You have to elevate yourself so that you can feel happiness in everything you do, in all acts. Another important factor that causes spiritual anguish is the thought of death and absolute extinction that many of us have. We think that death is extinction, is synonymous with annihilation. But in the Islamic faith, it is just a bridge or just a station to reach another station. A bridge between the two realms, the intermediate realm, which we call Barzakh, and the material universe. So death is a bridge between those two realms. And it is also a station to another station. It will link us, death will link us to the other realms.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? is Allah satisfied.
When death is believed to be the last limit of life and the end of everything, the awesome phantom of non-existence darkens the soul and pours bitterness into every joy of life. Psychic strain, despair, and despondency, especially in the later part of life, will put him or her in a state of painful mental torture. Thus, we need to study a little bit about death, talk with teachers about death, and see what the reality of death is, or at least read about what the reality of death is and reach a logic result of our research. Maybe we cannot feel what death is or see what death is with spiritual visions, with shuhud, but we may at least, the least level, the lowest of those levels, is that we can understand logically or try to understand logically what death is as a bridge that would link us to the next realm. And when we understand what lies behind death, and when we read about different masters and spiritual teachers and what they have said about death, then maybe we can feel a small bit of release and serenity, because we trust those people who have reached high levels of spirituality. And when they talk about what they have witnessed, when they talk about death, we feel tranquility because we trust their words. Similarly, a haunting fear of encountering some undefined danger, something one fears without being able to express precisely what terrifies him, misgivings and apprehensions cripple the soul and shatters man's nerves like a sledgehammer. This is the feeling that many of us may have when we have uncertainty about death and what lies behind death. One becomes constantly listless as a result of financial insecurity. Another aspect is the unmanageable wealth and 1,000 financial cares that you need to think about. All of those things that you need to think about. They might be financial, they might be family issues, they might be 1,000 other obstacles that has to do with your physical body, the mental perspective, and the spiritual perspective. All of those things that may cause your nerves to shackle, to shake, and reach a level where you do not feel that you are happy, or you might not feel that you are cared enough or loved enough, and all of those other things that may give you uncertainty. All of those things will give you despair, and those are the things that we will talk about, inshallah ta'ala, in more detail in future programs. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is
all I need. All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
You need to
love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.